Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. Westminster, Massachusetts is on our map today. The town of just under 7,000 people is looking to go cold turkey and ban tobacco sales within the town limits.
This meeting with all these cameras here is a mockery of this town in front of the United States of America.
Well, local store owners and liberty-loving townsfolk in Westminster are not happy. Our petty squabbles, right? Well, you know what was some great news? Yesterday, and the European Space Agency landing on Comet 67P. And that got us thinking beyond our own little map and about the future of space exploration. Will a day come when we realize that we are not alone? More on the search for life. That's later this hour. But we begin with a look at the state of our very own Affordable Care Act. Starting on Saturday, people who want insurance coverage will again have a chance to enroll for a health plan under the ACA. It's open enrollment for the second time. The Department of Health and Human Services says that by the end of 2015, more than 9 million Americans will be signed up for health care plans through federal and state exchanges. Mary Agnes Carey is senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, and she joins me now to help explain some tips for Americans looking to enroll this second time around. Hi, Mary Agnes.
Hi there.
Great to talk to you. You have some tips for consumers. Now, a lot of people signed up last year. They probably think they're set. They've got a plan. They don't need to do anything.
You can certainly do that. If you don't do anything, you'll be re-enrolled. But it's a good idea to go back to healthcare.gov and look at your options again. You might find that there are other choices that are better for you. So federal officials are asking people, go back on the site, compare those plans and prices, and see what's the best deal for you.
There are some places where prices might have gone down slightly or gone up. You don't want to pay more than you have to, in other words.
That's right. Particularly if you're in an urban area, there may be a lot of competition between those insurers to get your business. It's a little harder for folks in the more rural areas to get better prices. It can still happen there. A lot of it depends on the market forces in your area.
There was some concern. They call them glitches, and there were certainly plenty of them in the first year of open enrollment and a little beyond as this large program ramps up. There were some situations of people finding they were billed twice.
That's right. This is another problem. It's on what we call the back end of healthcare.gov. This is the part of the healthcare.gov website where the government talked to the insurers. And here's what's happening. They're still working out the details of how to tell insurers the folks who took no action and were just automatically re-enrolled in the plan they have, the people who actively re-enrolled in what they have, and the people we're just talking about who might have got on the site and picked a new choice. And so it's really important for consumers, as all this works out, as the billing starts, to make sure you're not billed twice if you picked a new plan that you didn't also get a premium bill for your old plan.
This sounds a lot like when I buy movie tickets online and it's working and it says, don't press the back button while this is happening. You could get charged twice.
Exactly. Exactly. It's just one of those kinks. You know, you're talking about millions of people getting insurance. Federal officials say they're working on it. Insurers say they're working on it. So it's one of those things where you've just got to keep your eye on either your checking account, if it's an automatic deduction, or your credit card statement, if you did it that way.
Mary Agnes Carey is senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Mary Agnes, you mentioned that prices in some big cities have gone down, or maybe in some places they've gone up. It's important for people to go back and look at their premiums, make sure they're not paying too much. But there's the other end of it. A lot of people are getting subsidies, money coming in. Those can change too.
That's exactly right. Let's say your income increased, the amount of subsidy that you might receive to help cover your premium costs will decrease. If you don't go in and update that financial income, you could get quite a surprise at tax time when the reconciliation would come. And if the federal government thought they gave you too much in subsidy assistance, it's going to come out of your tax refund. And similarly, if your income drops, you might be eligible to get more money for that subsidy. So it's important not only to get on and look at your options, but to also update your financial information so you're getting the most accurate amount of assistance if you qualify for that.
And this is we've only talked about premiums and subsidies, money going out, money coming in. Health insurance and what you pay is a little more complicated than that.
Exactly. There's also a lot of out-of-pocket costs. Things like you go to the doctor, you've got a co-payment. Co-insurance, where you have to kick in some money along with the health insurer for a particular service, or something called a deductible, where all the money's out of your pocket before your insurance kicks in. all those things combined are the financial impact on you. So when you look at a policy in the exchange, they have them through different tiers of coverage and prices. When you look at that, you really have to get that total picture. How much is the premium? What are my copays? What is the coinsurance? What are my deductibles, to understand all that money that's going to come out of your pocket?
There's a lot to understand here, Mary Agnes Carey. What is Sylvia Burwell, what is the government, HHS, saying about healthcare.gov and the phone numbers that you can call for help? Last year, we all went through the big disaster that was the launch of healthcare.gov. Is it working well enough so that all these questions that you're helping us with will be easy to answer by getting online?
The mantra from the administration has been improvement, but not perfection. They've talked about how they simplified the application process, in particular for people who've never gotten insurance on the exchange. They've increased the capacity of healthcare.gov, but they stress there may be some bumps along the way. So people should not only, in addition to looking at healthcare.gov, do you have an insurance broker who you might have used in the past? Go to them to get assistance. The law created categories of people called navigators and assisters. You can go onto healthcare.gov and find one of these folks that have been trained through federal government programs in your area to help you. There's also an 800 number on the website, 800-318-2596.
All right.
That way you can call and get assistance as well.
Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Know your costs, know your premiums. Mary Agnes, thank you.
Thank you.
Vladimir Putin in Russia is at it again, in Ukraine, also in Iran and China, as we're going to hear in just a couple of minutes. Back in Ukraine, hundreds of Russian-made vehicles and thousands of Russian troops have crossed the border in the past few days, according to eyewitnesses, putting Ukraine and the West on high alert for a possible new offensive.
We see forces that are capable of being nuclear that are being moved to Crimea. Whether they are or not, we do not know, but they do have the kind of equipment there that could support that mission.
That's General Philip Breedlove, NATO's Supreme Allied Commander, briefing reporters in Naples, Italy. In response, the UN Security Council convened its 26th emergency session to discuss the situation in Ukraine. Here's U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Samantha Power, speaking at that emergency session.
Russia has negotiated a peace plan and then systematically undermined it at every step. It talks of peace, but it keeps fueling war.
Well, as we have to keep asking ourselves every couple weeks, it seems, just what is Vladimir Putin up to? Kimberly Martin, professor of political science at Barnard College at Columbia University, and our friend and Putin expert. Welcome.
Thank you, Todd. It's great to be back.
And it's great to have you. Look, there was an election in Ukraine just a few weeks ago. Pro-separatist politicians and pro-Russian politicians got a trouncing. And a lot of people think that that's what is helping to fuel the latest incursions so that Vladimir Putin can tighten his grip on Ukraine.
Well, you know, Putin has really lost big time in two ways. First of all, he did push the Ukrainian population into Europe just with a definitive level of support that wasn't there before. And secondly, it's pretty clear that the sanctions aren't going away and they are having a big impact on the Russian economy. And so basically at this point, Putin has nothing left to lose. And so he might as well go for broke because he's got these two big blights on his record that aren't going away.
Now, what about Crimea? We heard the cut from General Breedlove about a sort of a separate issue of Russian troops moving into Crimea. One of the problems with Crimea, which has already been annexed by Russia, is that there's no physical connection between the land of Crimea and the mainland of Russia.
Yes, and there have been rumors for months, and we might be seeing these rumors come to pass as fact right now, that maybe Russia would try to move some troops and military forces along that southeastern coast of Ukraine to try to connect the rebel strongholds in Donetsk with a land bridge over to Crimea. And you'll remember that at the end of last summer, there was concern that there was fighting in Mariupol, which is the major city along that southeastern seacoast. And we haven't seen the Russian troops doing anything in that area yet, or the rebels doing anything in that area yet. But I think that's the long-term concern about what might happen.
That's strategically pretty easy to understand, Kimberly Martin, the need for a land connection, which would have to punch through Ukraine in this case to allow Vladimir Putin to supply Crimea. In eastern Ukraine, the rest of eastern Ukraine, it's a little more confusing to me. After a couple of elections, you say Vladimir Putin has nothing left to lose. What's his end game by reinvading and not only rearming Ukrainian pro-Russian separatists, but now reports of Russian troops making incursions into eastern Ukraine?
Well, you know, everybody keeps on asking what Putin's endgame is, and I don't think that we should assume that he necessarily has one. He's a tactical thinker rather than a strategic thinker, and that means that he will push wherever he can to get whatever he can. He is somebody who's got a KGB background of enjoying deceiving people, and so that means that he likes being unpredictable. And also, the decisions that are made in Russia are made by a very small group of advisors who aren't necessarily even government officials, and that means from the outside, it's always really hard to predict what Putin is going to do next. So I think we've got a couple of different possibilities. Maybe all he's doing is trying to strengthen the hold of the rebel forces that are located in Donetsk and in Lugansk with the idea that somehow he wants to make sure that there's no power coming from Kiev that's going to try to undo what he's achieved already. Or maybe his goal is to create a land bridge to Crimea. Or maybe he's got something longer term that could happen of trying to take even more territory in Ukraine. The Ukrainian military is not very strong. It's stronger than it was maybe a few months ago. But, you know, it's really no match for the full force of the Russian military if he decides he wants more. But he enjoys being unpredictable and deceptive, and so it's really hard to know what his endgame might be.
Well, at the same time, how much, if we can put a figure on this, and I don't know that we can, how much is he emboldened in this, in these tactics, by the fact that the United States has determined, and NATO has determined, it will not intervene militarily in this situation? We are sending weapons and training and help to Ukraine, but this seems almost like a toe up to the line dare, Vladimir Putin seeing how far west he can push, because he knows that that NATO won't be on the other end of that frontier.
But that's been true since the spring. And so there's nothing new that has happened. The new things that have happened are the fact that the sanctions are in place and maybe getting stronger and are having a huge impact on some sectors of the Russian economy, including the oil sector, which is really hurting because of the sanctions concerning Western help for Arctic oil development in particular, and also for the financing that now the oil companies can't get for further development from Western banks, and also the fact that the Ukrainian population has made it clear that they are interested in being part of Europe. And so it's really these negative pushes that are motivating Putin at the current time, not any change that's happened in what the U.S. or NATO is doing. Ukraine is not a NATO member. There was never any chance that NATO would help Ukraine against Russia.
So if there's no change in that situation, before we let you go, Kimberly Martin, is there a change in what the American or Western response has to be? Or do you kind of play rope-a-dope and say this is just another set of tactical moves by our KGB friend Vladimir Putin and not think that it amounts to much strategically?
Well, Putin is digging himself in further. And the one thing to keep in mind is that there is a law, a bill pending in the U.S. Congress that, if it were brought to the floor, would almost certainly be voted for by a majority of Congress and the Senate, that would make the sanctions against Russia a standing law rather than just an executive order. Right now, the sanctions are an executive order that can be lifted at any time. If Putin keeps on pushing, most likely that bill will be made into law, and that means that the permanent level of economic disruption between Russia and the United States, and probably Russia and Europe, would become much stronger and much more harmful to Russia.
It seems also that the new Republican Congress, which comes in January, would be much more likely to vote to actually arm Ukraine, send lethal aid and weapons.
I hope that doesn't happen, because the Ukrainian military at this point is really not a very heavily professionalized force. There are all kinds of independent militias fighting alongside the forces coming from Kiev. The government still has a great deal of corruption in it, and there is still a lot of Russian penetration of those Ukrainian forces. So I think it would be a big mistake to give actual military assistance that would involve U.S. weapons on the ground in Ukraine.
A lot of Republicans in Congress disagree. Kimberly Martin, professor of political science at Barnard College and Columbia University, our Putin expert. Thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
Reports are being sourced to White House officials today that the president will soon take executive action that spares as many as 5 million undocumented immigrants from deportation and gives many more the opportunity to apply for work permits. Meanwhile, thousands of children who over the summer flooded the southern border are still in limbo. And we wanted to take a minute to get an update about these thousands of children who have mostly dropped out of the headlines. Bishop Mark Seitz is bishop of the Diocese of El Paso, Texas, and he's seen many of these young children and their broken families firsthand.
I have to say that most of the people I've met are not really up to date on the debates that are going on in the halls of Congress or elsewhere. All that they know is that they were in fear of their lives where they were. They felt that they had to leave behind everything that was familiar with them and run someplace. And some of them have come to our country. Many went to other neighboring countries around them, and statistics show that. But the ones who came to us, they're just clinging to whatever little hope they might have and hoping that they can avoid the violence that they faced at home.
And in many cases, the decision to come here has been a real sort of low odds play. I'm reading that of over 1,500 cases, not 94% of children who were removed after having no lawyer during their adjudication.
Yes, we in the church have a tremendous concern about that. I just can't imagine putting myself in the place of these children, coming into a courthouse, finding myself in front of a judge and a government lawyer, and having to represent myself and respond to their questions, often asked in a different language. It's an impossible situation for these children to represent what that might be a very legitimate cause for some kind of protection.
Bishop Seitz, one of the policy questions that's come up was never resolved in how to deal with this influx of minors from Latin America has been some of the human trafficking laws that we have and how easy it is to deport a minor or another person who comes on the southern border if they might be a victim of violence at home or of human trafficking. Where do you think that might land? And having seen as many of the people as you have along the border there in El Paso and the outskirts, what do you think needs to be done?
Well, we do have a law that was passed by unanimous vote of Congress and signed by the president in 2000 and then reaffirmed by the Congress. I believe it was just last year, the Trafficking Victims Protection Act. And that's supposed to allow some kind of due process so that victims of human trafficking, this abuse of human beings of the worst imaginable kind, children and women in particular, can be prevented. If they come to us, we need to have processes in place so that we can find out whether this is the reason they came to our border before we deport them back into that unimaginably terrible situation that they only just left.
One of the aspects of that debate is whether to have the same law for people who arrive over the border with Mexico as for people who are from non-contiguous countries. And that may continue if the immigration debate ever gets solved in the next couple of years. But during that debate, Bishop Seitz, we talk about the battles between Republicans and Democrats, Congress, all the time. For somebody dealing with people on a daily basis the way you are, what are we missing about this debate? What is the nation missing, do you think?
I think the nation is missing the human face of the issue. We hear numbers, and numbers scare us, and people we do not know or understand frighten us. If only we could humanize this issue, come to grips with the reality that these are fellow human beings, and begin to somehow put ourselves in their place, I think we would come to more humane solutions that would reflect the goodness of our country and the goodness of our people.
Bishop Mark Seitz is Bishop of the Diocese of El Paso in Texas. Bishop, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, earlier this fall, the drugstore chain CVS quit tobacco entirely. You remember that. They said, we're not going to sell it anymore. Well, now an entire town in central Massachusetts wants to follow that lead and ban all tobacco sales within the confines of their municipality. If the measure goes into effect, the town of Westminster in Massachusetts would be the first town in the nation to ban all tobacco sales. The Board of Health says it wants to protect young people from tobacco companies, but merchants and restaurant owners and business people in the town are up in arms. Listen to this from a meeting of the Health Board before the town just last night.
This meeting with all these cameras here is a mockery of this town in front of the United States of America?
What did you think was going to happen? People are heated. People are angry.
This is a small town. You're taking away people's rights.
It got raucous, and that led the chair of the Board of Health, Andrea Crete, to call off the meeting.
It was getting too unruly, and people were being disrespectful and not following the ground rules.
Well, joining me now is DJ Wilson. He's director of the Massachusetts Municipal Association's Tobacco Control Program. He was at the meeting last night. DJ, welcome.
Hi.
Now, your organization helps towns like Westminster if they want to control tobacco, keep kids from smoking, stuff like that.
Correct. The association doesn't take a stand on these policies, but we help cities and towns that figure out what policies they want for their own community.
Okay, but at the same time, you were at this meeting last night. The question a lot of people are asking, look, I'm sure nobody got up and said, we love cigarettes, tobacco is a good thing. But does a ban prevent anyone, a 16-year-old or anyone else, from just driving to the next town?
Well, we think that especially for youth, all don't have cars. They all aren't driving. A lot of kids start smoking before they are eligible to even get a license. And so those impulse buys at local merchants is what the Board of Health was kind of intending to stop. Additionally, youth are bombarded by tobacco advertising every time they walk in a convenience store, and kids use convenience stores a lot.
So you maintain that this really is about minors, really about kids. It's not about adults who choose to smoke and making it harder for them.
No, I mean, adults will still be able to smoke if this ban went into effect because it doesn't affect the usage of tobacco. And the other issue that happens where Westminster is located, they're one town away from New Hampshire. So I suspect there are a lot of adult daily smokers that go to New Hampshire to save $30 on a carton of cigarettes.
Because the taxes are lower in New Hampshire.
Correct. By a lot.
Right. By a lot. And so that gets right back to the point. If you ban something in a small place, I get that 14-year-olds don't drive yet, but 14-year-olds don't drive to the beer store either. And I'll tell you, that didn't stop us.
But, you know, it's all about – part of this is about denormalization. So while restaurants and bars and workplaces went smoke-free in Massachusetts 10 years ago, now you would never think as an average resident to walk into one of those places and expect to see cigarettes. So we've denormalized the users of cigarettes. So we're trying to further denormalize the fact that kids aren't bombarded by tobacco advertising, aren't seeing a lot of smoking going on, and really aren't being allured by cheap flavored products, especially things like a 49-cent grape cigar.
So it's already the case that you don't walk into a bar in Westminster. You can't light up restaurants. Those are all non-smoking in Massachusetts anyway, right?
Yes, they've been by state law for 10 years.
Okay, but I own a convenience store, a gas station. Sure, I sell gas, but this is a small business, my friend, and you're going to kill us.
Right. I mean, it is an issue. They would be losing a line of product to be sold, so I can't deny that. But the Public Health Board in Westminster has decided to put public health first, and that's why they're making this consideration.
What's your response? You know, we saw some of the tape of the town meeting, people singing God Bless America. It's not a surprise that people who are against this ban feel like it's an arrow that goes to the heart of their idea of liberty, their ability to buy cigarettes, smoke cigarettes if they want to, right in their own town, I suppose. What's your response to that? There is no way around the idea that this is taking away some measure of freedom that people have to do a thing that's bad for them. But even if it's just a little bit, it is taking part of that away.
Right. Well, first, I do want to say the Select Board had a hearing on Monday that went really well. So it's unfortunate that last night's went so poorly. Second, we have, the same arguments happened when we were talking about making restaurants smoke-free. It's an issue, but this is a product that, reliably kills lots of people. It costs the American taxpayer a lot of money to care for these people. Every single person has somebody in their life who has died from cigarette use. There's no upside to smoking.
Well, new prohibition may be coming to Westminster, Massachusetts. DJ Wilson, director of the Massachusetts Municipal Association's Tobacco Control Program, thanks for updating us.
You're very welcome.
Well, we all watched with joy as that Rosetta spacecraft successfully landed Philae, the lander on Comet 67P, just yesterday. And one of the big questions that scientists are hoping we can answer from this mission is where the building blocks of life on Earth came from: water, elements like carbon and nitrogen. researchers are hoping that by tasting that really filthy, dirty intergalactic snowball that is Comet 67P, we might be able to learn more about the possibility of life outside Earth. After all, the raw materials that make up comets are the same raw materials that make up Earth, and presumably the same ones floating in other solar systems in the galaxy. Well, here to put the mission to Comet 67P into some context for the search for extraterrestrial intelligence is none other than Dr. David Black. He's president and CEO of the SETI Institute. That's a nonprofit organization dedicated to exploring the origin and nature of life in the universe. Dr. Black, what a pleasure.
Pleasure for me too, Todd. How are you today?
Very well. Now, Dr. Black, you've been doing some writing about how this comet mission that I just described helps the search for extraterrestrial life. How does it do that?
Well, you touched on that in your introduction. We believe that the process that led to the formation of our planetary system goes on around other stars, and the recent discoveries over the past 10 years or so of planets surrounding other stars lends credence to that. So what we're seeing as we look at this comet is presumably much like what we would see in comets that would be elsewhere around the other stars and would be responsible for helping to build up the planets that we see around those other stars. And as you indicated, one of the beliefs is that these comets were responsible for bringing much, if not all, of the water to our own planet and delivered many of the organic compounds that are essential to the startup and subsequent evolution of life. So as we see these and get a better understanding of the nature of these objects, presumably they are very similar to similar objects that we'd find around other stars. And so it gives us a hope, if nothing else, that we will have a good chance that this process that took place here has taken place on those planets around the other stars. And of course, SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, we have to have the life there in order to find it. So this gives support, generally speaking, to the notions that are behind SETI.
So at the same time, at the very best, we're not going to find spacemen or even bacteria, probably, on a comet. So what we're going to find is a bunch of raw materials, which then means that any evidence we get from this mission is, once again, raw materials and purely circumstantial.
That's right. And as I said, we found planets around other stars. That doesn't necessarily mean that those planets have life on them. But if we see and have a better understanding of the nature of comets as they deliver this raw materials for life to our planet, we can extrapolate that to the processes that would take place around these other stars. So it all is building a gradual support system for the idea that life is far more prevalent than we might have thought before.
And anyway, the search for exoplanets, a small subset of them, which we call Earth-like, is going gangbusters. I mean, you know, every 9 months or so, we have another planetary scientist on this show listing the next 120 planets that they've discovered.
Absolutely right. It's an exploding field. And in addition to that, the other thing that sort of goes hand in hand with the comet work is that we've found life in extreme environments many places here on the Earth. So our understanding of the conditions under which life can not only survive but prosper has expanded greatly over the last two decades or so. And so all these things work together to strongly suggest that their life might be far more prevalent than we thought. Whether it always evolves into an intelligent technological society is, of course, a separate question.
And I want to ask you that exact question because I'm interested in the direction you think this is most likely to take, as long as we're playing long odds here. You know, you're called the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, but it seems like if you're playing those long odds in a vast galaxy, you're probably more likely to have first contact with a microbe or the fossil of an extraterrestrial microbe than some fully formed space traveler from another world.
The way these searches are undertaken is they vary, actually. One way is to look for signs of intelligent life, and the way you do that is to look for the technology. The assumption is that if you find technology, for example, radio signals, intelligence is there. But more than likely, the early discoveries of life are not going to be through that mode, but rather using telescopes to study the atmospheres of these other planets. Because when you do that, you can actually tell whether there is life on the planet if you have the right kind of telescope. You can't tell if it's intelligent necessarily, but you can tell that it's got life. You can tell it just looking back at the Earth that life was here just by the nature of our atmosphere.
All of the oxygen in the atmosphere, the carbon as well.
That's right. The methane, the oxygen. If you were to take our atmosphere and put it in a jar, it would quickly convert to a completely different composition because oxygen is such a reactive species.
Well, you know, I'm troubled by one thing, Dr. Black, and I've been troubled by it for a long time. I'm not the only one, so I'm glad you're here. We don't want to go too far afield here, but inflationary expansion, which is happening in our universe every second, means that we're all moving away from one another at an increasingly fast rate. Every second that goes by, it gets harder and harder to run into someone else in the neighborhood because they're getting further and further away, and it's happening really, really fast. So that kind of counts against the effort. It's just getting harder to make the trip.
Well, when you say fast, it's fast in a cosmic timescale sense. It's not fast like a speeding car going by. That's over the scale of the universe as we understand it. So if you look at even within the context of our own galaxy, as huge as it is, the kind of expansion that you're talking about is nothing that we would even notice for thousands, millions of years. So I think we're safe in terms of whether a star or a planet in our own galaxy is going to wander off and move away from us. That's not going to happen because of the general expansion of the universe.
So as long as we stay in our own neighborhood, the Milky Way, we have a much better chance.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
All right.
And the kind of travel, the kind of detection, I don't think anybody is too seriously talking about yet about travel, unless it's Interstellar, the movie, of course. But then that's a different mode of travel altogether. That's through a wormhole. So,
well, in another popular movie, if we want to bring it up, Contact was made by doing what you just described, listening for radio signals, which came. The contact was in the form of radio signals from outer space.
Well, that's absolutely right. And in fact, the woman who was the protagonist in that is worked at the SETI Institute, so she was a real person.
And so was the founder of SETI and one of the authors of that movie, Carl Sagan.
That's right. That's right.
Dr. David Black is president and CEO of the SETI Institute, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Dr. Black, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for helping us put the Comet mission into much, much, much bigger context.
Well, you're welcome, Todd. Take care. Have a great day.
Hi, this is Mike Steele from Austin, Texas. And of course, we're going to discover extraterrestrial life someday, but math is inescapable. When infinity is a player, almost all things are possible. And see, I would tell the alien that I hope they can understand that humans are maturing and we're slowly getting past our monkey brain urges and insecurities.
We got this from Centerdale in Rhode Island. Yes, I would want the aliens to know that we are a selfish species, but we also have some redeeming qualities. We want your take at 8778MYTAKE. You can tweet us at The Takeaway. If you want to catch up on that conversation, listen back to anything you've heard on the show, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for the alien himself, John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.